It's permanent, so not very, very recent permanent, so. So I'll try to emphasize how to use this formula as an example to, I hope this helps. Most people have enjoyed computation for trivial amplitudes for a long time, but it's an interesting question. In some sense, it's a test of the formula, as well as, of course, hopefully you can get new information about these perturbative scattering amplitudes. So this new information is useful not just for checking properties like finiteness, but also for some of these duality conjectures, where you really need to know information about loop amplitudes. So of course there's the RNS formalism, which is very nice in the world sheet, but it's ugly in the target space in the sense that space-time supersymmetry is not manifest. So anything which involves space-time fermions doesn't all look very natural as a RNS form. So but if you want to talk about Ramon-Ramon backgrounds, that's another problem, but perturbatively you can of course discuss Ramon-Ramon backgrounds, it's just I don't know how much detail it's more possible to do. Certainly the formalism is much nicer for never short, which from the target space point of view is a little bit awkward. There's nothing more natural about never short from the target space point of view. So another problem with RNS, it's not really a problem, but obviously learned by built-in formulas. Some amplitudes have very simple answers, but they're very difficult to compute in the RNS formula, mainly because the space-time supersymmetry is somehow hard to dig out. So there's this alternative formalism now which can be quantized, so this pure spinner formalism, which space-time supersymmetry is easy to see. The world sheet description is a little bit more, I think it's not really awkward, but it's just mysterious. So there are some features that I will to introduce when I discuss the loop amplitude. I'm not well justified from some world sheet point of view, but they're justified just you have to say the word BRST invariance. And because BRST invariance is usually what happens when you try to gauge fix some symmetries of the world sheet, but that part of the story is not yet understood. Okay, so although I'm using transparencies, I invite lots of questions so interrupt me whenever you want. Transparencies are just because of lunch, so I'm sure people would. If I cite it in Blackboard, I won't be able to always pass, but the idea is chat questions. So, okay, so I'll start with this world sheet action, which it's gauge fixed just because I don't really know what the ungauge fixed world sheet action is. So, in ordinary computation of scattering amplitudes, the new feature that comes from the gauge fixing is the ghosts. So, it's natural to think of these x's and p's and theta's as matter variables, and in fact the x's and theta's are just the matter variables of Green-Schwarz, and p is this conjugate to theta which was introduced first by Siegel. It's natural. And then these ghosts have this beta gamma form, so they're bosonic. And in some sense you can think of them as coming from gauge fixing kappa symmetry, but not in a way that's well understood. So they're bosonic just because kappa symmetry is fermionic. And you can see there's no Virasoro ghost. So somehow these are already encoding the Virasoro ghost. Okay, so so the main starting point would just be to construct the VST operator. I apologize for the so the idea is you have a bosonic ghost which is constrained. So this is the main new feature, the formalism, which you have to work out the rules for working with constrained ghosts, and it turns out that you can work out the rules. Essentially, that's the new feature that you have to do. But once you've worked out these rules, there's no problem with working with these constrained ghosts. So the idea is that in 10 dimensions, you can construct this spinner, which is called a field spinner by Cartan, which satisfies this identity, lambda gamma lambda equals zero. So lambda is a 10-dimensional, work in SO10, but if you force me, I can recode it in back to SO91. So it's 16 components, naively, but because of this constraint, you find that 5 of the 16 components are related to the other 11. And you can solve the constraint in a non-covariant way in this form if you want. So this UAV is this 10 of U5. So you can, the simplest way to solve it is in this manner that preserves the U5 shut loop of the feeding SO tank. So you find that the 11 components of lambda describe this complex space SO tank over U5. That's 10 components, 10-dimensional complex space, and then you have the scale part of lambda. And now, because of this constraint, the conjugate momentum also has this gauge invariance, which means that only 11 of the W's are gauge invariant with respect to this gauge invariance. So naively, it looks like the 10 components can be gauged away, but because of this pure spinner constraint, actually only 5 can be gauged away. So in this U5 decomposition of those 16 component spinner, it splits up into a 1, 10, and 5. This is the 1, 10, and the 5. And you can gauge the 5 of W away. So V can be thought of as the conjugate to U, and beta can be thought of as the conjugate to gamma. And these are the U1 charges of the spin. So because of this gauge invariance, W can only appear in certain combinations. So if you want to work just in terms of gauge invariance W, which is very convenient, then you can construct either the two form.
This part will remain secret forever.
Okay, so you can build the two form, which is just the Lorentz current, the Gauss number current, and of course the stress tensor out of the pure spinner. And you can compute the OPEs of these objects. And of course, these are covariantly transforming objects, so the OPEs are covariant. And if one wants, one can compute them using this U5 decomposition, but there are other ways to compute them all. The important point is just that lambda transform is a spinner under this Lorentz current, and these central charges. So you have a double pole of N with N, which has level -3, and you have a Gauss number anomaly of -8, and a central charge of 22. So this cancels the central charge anomaly, so there's no need to introduce these Virazora ghosts. Of course, that's not just canceling central charge is not enough to say that you don't need Virazora ghosts, but when we compute the cohomology, it will be clear that you don't. And in fact, this level here is precisely correct in order to cancel. So if you add it to the level of the SO91 coming from the thetas, from these thetas, so this is the spin degrees of freedom, essentially these two sets of fields are supposed to reproduce the psis in RNS. So the level of the spin current in RNS is just 1. So you can see that you also get the right total level here. And there's a Gauss number anomaly of -8, which is a bit bizarre. So the most direct way is to use this decomposition. So that's a non-covariant computation, not manifestly covariant. But of course, if this decomposition is correct, then you can just, once you write the ends in terms of these fields, you can just compute the OPEs using these as free fields. Right. So in this gauge, so I gauge these 5 W's to 0, then the action is in fact exactly of the same type that you were discussing in your talk. So it's of the type UAB. And I just beta to gamma. So this would be the action. So you just have the usual free field OPEs between the U's and V's. And this goes like 1 over 1 minus V and beta to gamma. Now, the lambdas I already wrote down in terms of the gammas and U's. The next step is to write the N's in terms of the lambdas and the W's. So formally you can write it in this way, but now you have to normal order. And the normal order is going to introduce these terms like d log gamma, which is the same type of these corrections that you discussed in your. So now, using, I'm sorry? So t also involves d log gamma. So constructing the terms needed for normal ordering, they're just guaranteed. Once you to reproduce these Lorentz covariant OPEs, that essentially tells you how to normal order. Now, to get these central charges is actually not so difficult. So the -3 you can get without any normal ordering. It just comes from, you just compute NAB. So this is the U5 subgroup of the SO then you just have something like this. So if you choose A different from B, that's the only contribution. And it's easy to compute the central charge from that. So omega with lambda is more complicated because that doesn't have a covariant OPE. So W is not the gauge invariant object. So the point is that if you try to compute W, if you try to say that W alpha with lambda beta goes like delta alpha beta over Y minus Z, you'll run into problems because that will mean that this has an OPE with the constraint. So you shouldn't do that. So you can't write this in a covariant way. You can write it in various non-covariant ways. You can introduce a direction and subtract off contributions from that direction. Yeah. So the natural thing to do is always to write W in these Lorentz covariant gauge invariant combinations, and those OPEs are perfectly covariant.
We're also going to start lambda belonging to arbitrary manifold.
You have to. I don't know what kind of constraint you're going to use, but you want. I don't know how this works in general. I can't.
So you use in process of this derivation some special properties of this equation.
So certainly. I want to use the fact that in this gauge, these just become free fields. So I had a gauge invariance which allowed me to get rid of these five W's, and in that gauge, it's just U dV plus gamma d beta.
Or you could use S of n invariance.
Somehow. I think directly you use the free fields to just generic feature of this first order system. You need the first word. You need S of n covariance. You need set of caps to
Well, I started with this. Well, okay. In some sense, I'm telling you what the rules are. Now, you're asking me if I start with some more general system, can I always write it in terms of these free fields? I don't know. It depends how general you want it to be. But certainly, this system can be described in terms of free fields in a non-covariant way. But there's no. I prefer to always work in terms of these. So essentially, all I'm going to use is OPEs anyway. Yeah, so N is perfectly well defined, but the W is not. So if you force me, well, yeah. So Nikita has worked out this stuff, and maybe you should give a talk on how to use your approach, or what you talked about to this, but I haven't worked on that one. Okay, the other questions? So far it's just OPEs and not so interesting. But now the interesting part comes when you put in the BRST operator. So of course, you're not allowed to just write down any state. So the idea is you write down states which are in the cohomology of this BRST operator. So D alpha is constructed from the fields I'm calling matter fields, this X and theta and P. And this D alpha is, in fact, is precisely what Green and Schwartz would have called the fermionic first and second class constraints. So if you just start with the Green-Schwartz action and you ask that you define P alpha to be the momentum for theta, then you find that it's not independent of theta, but so they would say D alpha equals zero. In this formalism, D alpha is not set to zero, it's just some independent field. But because of part of D alpha was first class and part of D alpha was second class, that means that D has an OPE with itself, and the OPE is just proportional to the gamma matrix. So I'm using 16 by 16 gamma matrices. So these are symmetric in 10 dimensions. And pi m is just a supersymmetric version of the momentum. So because of this OPE for D, and because lambda gamma lambda equals zero, then when you compute the anticommutator of Q with itself, you just get lambda gamma lambda times pi, but lambda gamma lambda is zero. So that tells you that Q is nilpotent. So this is also some slightly bizarre feature that normally when you have second class constraints, you don't construct the BRST operators. You first convert them somehow to first class constraints. Whereas here, D alpha really involves first and second class constraints, but because lambda is constrained, this lambda gamma lambda equals zero, that allows you to write this nilpotent object. Now, that's one way to think about it. But because I don't know other examples of this, it's hard to say exactly what the most general what the most general thing to do is. So from the worldsheet point, so from the space-time point of view, it's clear. From the space-time point of view, it's the worldsheet version of the space-time derivative. So as I'll show in the next transparency, so if you just write dd theta alpha, that would be the analog of p alpha. But this is not space-time supersymmetric, because the space-time supersymmetry generator shifts x to something like x plus epsilon gamma theta. So if you want to make something which is supersymmetric, you have to add these terms here. So p alpha will shift under supersymmetry, but that shift will be canceled by the shift in this theta. So d alpha, if you think of that, it corresponds to dd theta. This is corresponding to dd theta alpha plus theta gamma m ddx. And the reason for this cubic term is just to get rid of the double pole. We didn't have this term, so you can't see this from the space-time point of view just because of the worldsheet derivative, but this term is necessary in order that d with d just has a single pole.
But
this is a space-time supersymmetric derivative. So this commutes with, so the space-time supersymmetry generator would be dd theta minus.
Right.
So it's the usual story, as in four dimensions. You can construct.
In other words, there's no explanation.
It depends how you define good explanation, but. So the zero, it doesn't contribute to zero mode. So you won't see it from some, just if you think about just target space field theory, you won't be able to understand this term. But for me, well, for Siegel, I also had this term. I mean, it just, if you look at the worldsheet version of Q alpha, so the worldsheet version of Q alpha will also have some theta, d theta term. And space-time supersymmetry implies that you have this term.
As soon as you said the alpha to zero, then you will get that the green choice momentum, the alpha will just get the momentum of the green choice.
Yeah, so if you start with if the green Schwarz action is geometrical field, I don't know what way you want to start, then this is the constraint. This setting to zero would be the constraint from the green Schwarz action. Okay, but you need some worldsheet to see this term here. Just because d theta equals zero. So from the target point. Okay, so physical states are just defined using the usual definition, which from this point of view, it's just by hand. It doesn't come from some gauge fixing, but it's the only natural thing to do. And it turns out to give the right answer. Okay, so how does one know that it gives the right answer? Well, the easiest example is just for the massless state. Okay, so the simplest example is just, let's do the open string. It generalizes in an obvious way for the closed string just by taking the left-right product of two open strings. So the reason why it works is related to the fact that for Super-Yang-Mills, as I'll show, the Bianchi identities turn out to imply the equations of motion. So this is something special about 10 dimensions. So in 10 dimensions, for people who don't know it, it's hard to write off-shell actions which are manifestly space-time supersymmetric. And that's related to the fact that it's very hard to take the theory off-shell. Well, for this case, I'm just discussing cohomology, so I'm only discussing on-shell states anyways. So if one just writes the most general state of Gauss number one, which doesn't depend on the non-zero modes, so this would be the lowest state in the theory. So the higher massive states would come by allowing dependence on non-zero modes, so on creation operators. So the zero modes, you just have the x's and the thetas. Those are the conform weight zero objects. So this is the most general thing you can write down, which is linear in lambda. Now qv equals zero implies this, where so d alpha just acts like the supersymmetric derivative. And you can see that, so qv equals zero just tells you that this supersymmetric derivative of A is zero. And the gauge transformation is just that delta A alpha is just D alpha of some scalar superfield. So this equation, together with this gauge invariance, turned out to describe superhanging Mills. That's because this equation here, because any bi-spinner in 10 dimensions can be expressed in terms of a 1 form and a 5 form, but the 1 form vanishes, so you just get a 5 form here. And now, because of this equation, that just tells you that this 5 form combination of dA is vanishing. Now, how does one show that this describes superhanging Mills? Well, one can do it by brute force, just by taking some arbitrary superfield and imposing that this equation vanishes up to this gauge invariance and see what's left. So you find that you can gauge away everything which is zeroth order in theta. At linear order in theta, you get the usual vector gauge field, which satisfies the linearized Yang-Mills equation, or just Maxwell equation. Then at quadratic in theta, you get the Gluino, which satisfies the usual massless Dirac equation. And then you just get derivatives of these A's and psi's. Because of this constraint here, all the higher all the terms which are higher order in theta are related to A and psi by derivatives. So it just gives the field content of superhanging Mills. So how does one see this from a more covariant viewpoint? Well, if one just thinks about covariantizing the supersymmetric derivatives in flat space, well, it's natural to think of A alpha as being the gauge superfield, the spinner gauge superfield, which covariantizes D alpha. And then you introduce a vector superfield, which covariantizes DM. So this is, of course, natural if one wants to work in superspace. And the Bianchi identity tells you that del alpha with del beta is just going to be related to del M. So in flat, without the connection, this is, of course, true. So when one covariantizes it, one also wants it to be true. Now that implies, first of all, that AM is related to A alpha. They're not independent. And it also implies that the 5-form part of A alpha, when you take a derivative, is vanishing. It's because there's just a 1-form here, no 5-form. And AM is, of course, the lowest component of it is just the vector. One can also construct field strengths using this method. So the field strengths are just as usual, constructed by commuting the gauge field with the covariant derivative. So to linearized order, you get the field strength whose lowest component is the Gluino. So that's W alpha. And if you commute D alpha with W, you get the field strength whose lowest component is just the vector field strength. So this is exactly the same structure as in four dimensions. The only difference is in four dimensions, this Bianchi identity does not put the theory on shell. So it does not force AM and psi to satisfy the equations of motion, whereas in 10 it does. Okay, are there any questions?
Those of us who, like me, who knows nothing about 10-dimensional superhanging Mills, why it looked like in W alpha doesn't, there's some spinorial part that didn't occur in that definition?
Right, so I could have taken, so if I commute del alpha with del M, then that's right. You find a term which is proportional to W,
right.
And then you could get other terms.
Exactly.
Those other terms cancel because of this Bianchi.
Oh, okay.
So this is the only term.
Okay.
This is the only field string you can construct. And similarly, if you do del alpha with W beta, in general, you could get a 2-form and a 4-form. But again, the 4-form is forced to vanish because of the Bianchi. OK, another question? OK, so now we have, so this was the open string massless sector. One can go ahead and do the closed string massless sector. That's almost guaranteed to work. You just take the holomorphic square of this, and you get the supergravity state. The massive ones are more interesting, just because the massive ones in superspace, the equations of motion have not even been written down. So we constructed together with a postdoc, we did the first massive level. And then we showed that there's a cohomology argument to prove that this actually reproduces the correct spectrum, so the light cone spectrum. So this cohomology does give the right answer, and so now one has a simple BRST operator. So what are the rules for computing scattering amplitude? Okay, so let me start with tree amplitude. Okay, so the simplest amplitude is, of course, the three-point amplitude. So one wants to just take three vertex operators. So for the massless states, we have these three BRST invariant vertex operators. So how do we compute this three-point amplitude? So one, of course, should integrate over the the worksheet fields. The non-zero modes, of course, are trivial because of the three-point amplitude, but you have the zero mode. So one needs rules for computing the zero mode part. Now, for the x and theta, it's trivial, but for the lambdas, we have this constrained ghost. So we need the rules for integrating over these 11 independent lambdas. And one can show that this combination here, so if I go back to this U5 description where lambda was I have a description where lambda alpha is and W. I guess maybe. Then you can show that this object here is an SO10 scalar. So under Lorentz transformations, which will mix these U's and gammas in a complicated way, this is in fact invariant, which means one can also write it in a Lorentz covariant way in terms of just, you take any 11 components of lambda you like, and if you divide by this object here where you choose the same 11 components of the alphas, you'll get this here. So this writing it this way just corresponds to a certain choice of these alphas, but you could have chosen any other combination. Okay, so this tensor here is a Lorentz covariant tensor, which has 11 indices, Fanorian indices, anti-symmetrized, and 3 symmetrized. And this is gamma matrix traceless. So if you take the gamma matrix trace on any of these 3 symmetrized indices, you should get 0. Okay, the way I wrote it here, I haven't yet subtracted off the gamma matrix trace in this definition. So this is obviously a Lorentz scalar, just a contraction of these combinations of gamma matrices. And if you subtract off the gamma matrix trace, then that gives you this T here. Or if you like, these lambdas, because of the gamma matrix trace, because they automatically project out the gamma matrix trace. OK, so because of this definition, although it's D lambda is kind of strange because you have to divide by these 3 lambdas here, what we find when we compute the amplitude is we always have these 3 lambdas in the numerator. So this object here is well-defined, and it's just you just invert this matrix. It just means essentially raise all the spinner indices instead of leaving them. So you just reverse, put the alphas on the bottom and the beta, gamma, delta on the top just by switching the indices on the gamma matrices. Then you have this expression here. Okay, so this expression involves an integral over 11 of these lambdas. So naively, that gives you infinity. Now, that's not so strange. As soon as you have these bosonic ghosts in the theory, one has this same situation. So even in RNS, where we have these beta-gamma ghosts, there's a similar situation where you just naively integrate over the beta and gamma zero modes, you get infinity. But in RNS, we have these operators which involve delta of gamma and delta of beta. So in the Verlinde-Verlinde description of picture-changing operators, these bosonized objects have the property that they can be interpreted as delta of gamma and delta of beta. So we'll have to introduce something similar here. Are there any questions? Okay, so how does one do that? Well, of course, in RNS, one has this natural interpretation of picture-changing operators as coming from integration over supermoduli. In this formalism, I just have to put them in by hand because I don't really understand yet what these supermoduli are. So I'm looking for BRST invariant objects which have the property that they involve either delta of gamma or delta of beta, or delta of lambda or delta of W. So for tree amplitudes, I just need delta of lambda. So this object here has the correct property. So remember that Q is lambda alpha d alpha. So if I take Q of this object, I'll call Y. So first of all, I have to choose a fixed direction. This is something not so obvious, but because lambda is not the Lorentz, so in RNS, gamma is just a Lorentz scalar, space-time scalar. Here, it's a space-time spinner. So if you want to define delta of these components, you have to do them by choosing direction. It will turn out that the choice of the direction is irrelevant for the scattering amplitudes, but at the intermediate stages, we'll have to have these fixed directions. So the definition for this operator, which depends on delta of lambda, which I'll call picture lowering just because it's the analog of delta of gamma in RNS, it has this form here. So if you take Q of it, it's clear it's zero because Q of lambda is zero. And Q of theta is just lambda. Now you can show that if you take the derivative of y, the Wilczek derivative, it's easy to show that it's BRST trivial, like the RNS picture lowering operator. And furthermore, you can show that if you change the direction, you just take its derivative with respect to c, you find that it's q of something. So it's not too difficult to do the computation. So q of this object here, so delta. So you get two terms. You get the term theta alpha delta c theta lambda. And then you get a term c theta times lambda delta prime c lambda. And it's not difficult to show that these two terms here can be written as q of this. Okay, so these objects are BRST invariant, and up to some BRST trivial quantity, they're independent of C and where you put them on the world sheet. So now we can define the three-point amplitude in this way. So we have these 11 integrals over lambda, so we need to have 11 delta functions, which will restrict the components so that I just take, so that the 11 infinite integrals now give me just some constant. Now, naively, when you do this computation, you'll get dependence on C, but just because of this BRST trivial property, that dependence will drop out.
You've taken C1 up to C11 all different implicitly, but you could have taken them all the same.
You could have. So if you take them all the same, then what you'll find is that Y would have a pole with itself coming from when two delta functions come together, and it would have a zero when the two C's come together.
Okay,
so it's simpler if you choose the C's different, but there's a limit in which you can take them all the same. Okay, so this is the amplitude one has to compute for the tree amplitude. And it's not difficult now to do the computation. So the y's, each y will give you a theta, which means there's essentially five thetas left over that have to come from these superfields here. And the indices on these five thetas are contracted with the indices coming from these a's just to this t function. So when I do this integral over five thetas, it has these, naively would have five anti-symmetrized indices, but through this t function I can convert those five anti-symmetrized indices to three symmetrized gamma matrix traceless indices.
So you don't have to capture the integrals over lambda because it's c integers of lambda?
Yeah, because that's right. Because of these delta functions, well, there are different ways to do the integral, but essentially one just needs the rules for how one, one has this d lambda 11 and then one has these 11 delta functions. And this is going to give you some function of the C's. And you just need the rules for that. And it's not difficult to look at. Yeah, so, okay, so, go ahead. You'll probably give a better answer than I will anyway.
What he's doing, he has to define some variable functions on the C interface. You can declare a function with function because you want to declare a function with the amorphous of the deformed. So with those functions, you can think of them really as a better way to think of them as like one of the C lambda. So then the thing would have to raise you. It's not funny about saying it's one of the C lambda because then you can recalculate Q of the IC of the one.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
So there is one cohomology which is important to discuss. I was wondering, so what you can say is that the finding is the result of the
three components.
Yeah. So if you'd like, it's just some rules until you get some BRST invariant object. Huh? Okay, so if one goes ahead and does the computation, this is just something fifth order in theta, and if you go back and look which field sits fifth order in theta, and these you just reproduce the usual cubic superangular couple. Okay. So this is the most trivial test. Okay, now one wants to do higher point tree amplitudes. So now one needs integrated vertex operators. So one wants an expression of this type, of course the number of y's don't change because I'm not changing the number of zero modes, but now I need to introduce integrated operators. And I don't have these B and C ghosts which tell me how to convert unintegrated to integrated, so I have to use this inverse procedure which takes me from integrated to unintegrated. So if you take Q of any integrated of the integrand of the integrated vertex operator, so this has dimension 1, Q of it should be the derivative of something of dimension 0, which is in the cohomology. So defining this U depends, of course, on V. We know what V is for the massless state, and what you find is that U for the massless state has this nice form. So if you go back and look, for example, at what the integrated vertex operator is in Green-Schwarz language, it would just have the first two terms. So it would have just d theta and pi. So if I just take some curved background and I look to linearized order what it is around the flat background, then I would just get these first two terms. Now in this formalism, you need these other terms just because of BRST invariance, or if you like, because of this procedure here. And also in RNS language, you can see that that's not so unnatural. In RNS, remember, the vertex operator involves not just the gauge field, but also the field strength. And in fact, this field strength here, the lowest component of it, is playing the same role as this field strength here. Okay, so this is the massless vertex operator. Now one can go ahead and compute these amplitudes. Now, it's not difficult to do just because for tree amplitudes, I can eliminate all the dimension 1 fields. So I have these fields d theta, pi, d, and n, which appear in this vertex operator. But I know they're OPEs with all the other fields. So I can use the OPEs of these fields to just replace them by the poles coming from the OPEs. And so after eliminating, if you like, functionally integrating over the non-zero modes, I just am back to the zero mode computation of the three-point amplitude. So I end up getting some function here, which now depends on the z's because of the integration over the conformal weight 1 field. And now this just gives me some explicit expressions. And one can show explicitly this agrees with the RNS tree amplitudes, at least for the case when all the states are Neuver-Schwarz. Now, in this formalism, of course, there's no more difficulty in computing Ramon than Neuver-Schwarz. It's just a different component in a state expansion. But of course, comparing with RNS is more complicated because that hasn't been computed.
This may not be, I guess this certainly isn't the point of your talk, but what contours are you integrating these U's along?
The U's? So in open string theory, when one fixes three points, so one fixes, let's say, Z1 equals, usually one fixes Z1 equals 0, Z2 equals 1, Z3
just
equals
1. The locations on the rest of the...
That's right, so it would go from Z... Okay, so...
On the boundary, okay. So you're integrating, I know about that, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's the same as in open bosonic string theory.
Some simplex or... Mm-hmm. Configuration space and the circle. Okay.
I'll see the question. I don't know if I should be evaluating this integrated vertex operator with the RNS vertex operator.
Yes.
If I would have tried to compare them, they will not start.
Yeah, so let's do it. Okay, so yeah, that's a good question. So let me answer it. So I need to erase. So you have. So this was in fact used for showing the equivalence. So what you have to do is you have to take out all the terms which, suppose I have a constant field strength, just to simplify. So the field strength of course appears here, here and here, and also here, but here it appears in higher theta components. So you'll get the term of the type AM, okay, so AM would couple to DXM, that appears from here. So AM would couple, okay, that comes from the pi term, and from the A alpha term you would get AM theta. So this essentially cancels this part here, so you just look with AM dA. Then the field strength, okay, it appears here at cubic order in theta.
Okay, I'd like to see the P theta term.
Yeah, so the P theta term comes from here. So W. So you'll get some terms which involve theta squared d theta, and then you'll get p theta coming from here, and you'll get an n coming from the last one. And the point is, this term won't contribute just because there aren't enough p's to cancel it. And these have the same central charge like the psi m psi n. Okay, any other questions?
Out of curiosity, is there an algorithm known, or even a guess of one, which would allow the construction for higher mass states?
So, of course, you can write down the generic state, but then you want to ask which states are in the cohomology. So what are the constraints coming from QV equals zero? So, of course, there's an algorithm. It depends what you mean by algorithm. You just compute Q on, so you write down the most general massive vertex operator.
Oh.
So let's do it at first massive level, which was done. So then instead of A alpha, you would have A alpha M. So this could couple to pi M, for example, plus B alpha beta. So this is supposed to be the unintegrated one. So I'm just writing down everything you can write down, which has the appropriate conformal rate. And finally, you could have something which involves B lambda. So if I haven't made a mistake, these are all the dimension one operators you can construct of Gauss number one. So you call this V, and then you ask, what does QV equals zero imply for these superfields? And work it out. So that was worked out to that level. But this is, of course, already involves 128 plus 128 states. So it's complicated. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, so now loop amplitude. So let me start with one loop amplitude. So in this case, I will have zero modes, not only from the lambdas, but for the w's. So these are conformal weight one objects, which have genus G surface, have G zero modes. So when I do my functional integral, I'm going to not only have to involve picture lowering operators, which involve delta of lambdas, I'll have to have picture raising operators, if you like, which involve delta of W. But W does not appear, is not gauge invariant. So it's better, instead of working with delta of W, to work at delta of the gauge invariant objects. So there are obviously 11 independent gauge invariant objects I can construct out of W just because I have 11 independent W's. So I have this J, which was the Gauss number current, and I also have the N's, which are the Lorentz currents. So I'm going to choose 10 of them to involve these, which I'll call ZB, and I'll choose also one of them to be of this type. So that's the way I'm going to restrict the integration over the zero modes for W. Now, there might be a nicer way to do this, but at the moment, this is the only way I know how to. So I have to choose, again, these directions. And again, the choice of the direction is irrelevant just because if I change the direction BM, this picture raising operator will change by something which is BRST trivial. So that's not difficult to show just because these picture raising operators are in fact almost BRST trivial. As in RNS, the picture raising operator can be written as Q of something which is, if you like, in this large Hilbert space. So this is supposed to be the step function whose derivative is the delta function. So this is, if you think of this as being the analog of Xi, so in RNS, Xi can be thought of as a step function of beta in Verlinde-Verlinde approach. Okay, so this is these are the operators I'm going to have to introduce, which are going to fix the zero mode integration for the lambdas and w's. And one would like a more geometrical way of understanding them, but at the moment I'll just put them in by hand. Okay, for one loop I have one unintegrated and n minus one integrated, and I need, of course, one b ghost. Okay, so the lambda integration over the zero mode is, as I told you before, there's a similar story for the n's. So you can write the W's, integration over 11 W's in a Lorentz covariant way in this form. So the power of gamma you need just because of, you can check just by the U1 charge, it needs to have this type of, this power of gamma. And I didn't mention, this has Gauss number 8. As you can see, it's 11 minus 3. And this has Gauss number minus 8. So that corresponds, that's because of this Gauss number anomaly of minus 8. Okay, so this integration over W's can also be written in this Lorentz covariant way. So you have these 10 n's and 1 j whose integrations are going to be fixed by these delta functions here. And you can see this involves 20 free indices here. And in fact, to get the right Gauss number, you need to have 8 lambdas in the denominator, each of which is contracted with a 5 form, which has 20 indices. So these 20 indices here are correlated with these 20 indices here. And you can choose them in different ways if you like.
Keep asking some basic questions, but I don't know. It's very string theory. So, what is your world sheet in a one loop? I just don't know.
So the world sheet action is the same. The only difference is
the actual geometry of the. That's right.
So it's integrated over a Riemann surface now of minus one.
But I thought that in the open string theory you need.
So I'm going between open and closed in without telling you when I'm going. But if I was doing open string theory, it would just be on an annulus.
Okay, that's what I So, but you're not here. I'm confused. Now I'm really confused.
No, it's the same number of zero modes. So.
But you're still integrating your U's over a contour. So now I don't know what the contour is anymore.
Okay, so I have the boundary of the annulus.
So you're doing it around the little. You're doing it in little circles around some marked points on the torus. Oh, now we're back on the annulus.
So this is the annulus. Okay. For the closed string, this is integrated over the whole. It's a dimension 1-1 object, which is integrated over everything.
Right. Okay.
So those rules are exactly like in bosonic string theory.
For the annulus, could I?
Yeah, so for the annulus, they're integrated over the boundary. So you have, so this would be the open string, and this would, they're integrated, for example, over here, over points in here.
Oh, yeah.
Is there lambda and m? Do they have an integral of e? When you insert both lines, you have divergence because of the OPE of lambda and m.
So lambda and n's will have OPEs with these y's and z's. So when I compute the correlation function, they will involve poles with this. So that will come into the correlation function.
So how do you compute OPEs under the delta functions?
So the n, so they will give you derivatives of delta functions. So if I compute, for example, n with delta, let me just ask this question for tree amplitudes. So this will have a pole, or delta C lambda. Let's say, so this will go like gamma MN C lambda C divided by Y minus C times delta prime of C lambda. The derivatives of delta functions, they only give you something non-zero if you have a lambda to soak up the derivative. So I'm forced, I could try to write this in terms of the Bose-Nice notation of Friedan, Martin, and Schenker, but it's a little bit awkward just because they're not target space scalars. So it's more convenient to use this delta function language. Yeah, if I interpret this as 1 over C lambda squared. Yeah.
Did you just give this expression so you can characterize it again as some cohomology?
Well, you can write. Sorry, this is in the cohomology.
Yes, but is this choice unique, or you could choose something?
Well, you can choose up to. Of course, you can choose the direction of B how you like. So, but that only changes something by BRST trivial. You're asking if there's some other state in the cohomology which has. No, I don't think so. I think these are so states which involve a delta of W. These are the only states in the at zero momentum. These are the only states. So of course, at non-zero momentum, you're going to get the whole every state in the theory should exist at any picture. So this would be the analog of the identity in the zero picture. This would be that's the idea. So in some sense, all of these are equivalent up to BRST trivial objects. So I could have chosen either. So it's clear that choosing different Bs is irrelevant. And in fact, you can also show that the difference of these is BRST trivial. So I think any. I don't know if that was your question. Right? So you could have asked the question in RNS. So what does a picture-changing operator? Is it the only state in the cohomology which raises the picture? Yeah, and I think there is just one state in the cohomology which raises the picture.
Okay.
So that would correspond to the identity in picture one. So this has not been, certainly not nearly as carefully worked out as in RNS, but the general idea should be the same. I'm sorry? Well, there are two ways to understand picturism. So in Frieden, Martinek, Schenker, they discuss this identification with different choices of the vacuum. So you can choose the vacuum to be annihilated by the beta zero mode or by the gamma zero mode. And that's two different choices of the picture. And you can also have beta one mode or beta two mode. And that's more in line with this logic. So now one can ask, in that picture, what are the states in the cohomology? And they argue that essentially it's the same states as in the picture zero cohomology, just multiplied by this picture changing operator. Okay, then one can go back to the question about supermoduli, and that relation I don't have here, but the relation with choice of the vacuum I think is in a similar vein to this. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, so the missing feature, which I haven't discussed yet, is this Beagles, and that's probably the messiest part of the formalism at this point, which is because W can only appear through these Gauss number neutral combinations, there's no object you could construct which satisfies Q with B as T, just because there's nothing of negative Gauss number which is gauge invariant. Now the trick that's going to be used is instead of trying to define B, we're going to define some object, instead of something which satisfies this, we'll define something which satisfies this. And Z turns out to have Gauss number plus one. So although there's no B which satisfies this, there is a B tilde which satisfies this. Okay, and this one can just solve this cohomology question. It's clear the Q of this is zero. So one can ask, okay, what state satisfies this? So first of all, this is some non-local object because I put Y and Z at different points. But it turns out that it's easy to write B tilde in terms of something which is local plus something which can be written explicitly. That's just because moving Z around is a BRST trivial operation. So now the question is, how does one define BB? So it should satisfy just Q of it, gives you just T of Z at the same point. And one gets this expression, which is complicated. But to compute amplitudes, at least the amplitudes with low number of external states, it turns out that just zero mode counting is going to mean that only certain terms in this B ghost can contribute. So the terms which you can contribute for the amplitudes I'll be looking at, whether just four-point amplitude, are ones which involve, for example here, it involves four Ds and a derivative of the delta function. There are lots of other terms. But if you don't have enough Ds coming from the B ghost, you'll find the amplitude vanishes just by zero mode counting.
Point is the, I assume that's the first point, the first number at which something's
non-zero. Yeah. So the 3-point will vanish from massless state.
Oh, right.
Okay, so now one has this expression for the Beagles, at least the terms which will contribute. And one now has to do the functional integration. So for massless states, okay, you have one massless and these n minus one integrated vertex operators. And now one has to work with zero modes not only of the lambdas but also of the conformal 8-1 field. And they'll be treated in the usual way. So you just separate off the zero modes and you integrate out the non-zero modes separately. So that would be a problem, of course, if I didn't have these delta functions of the zero modes. Okay, the non-zero mode has this nice property that the partition function vanishes. So that's something, well, it's something similar to topological strings, but in usual bosonic string or in the RNS formulation, the partition function does not, the partition function is one. So in the RNS or bosonic string computation, the partition function is something complicated, just because you have fields of different conformal weight. In this formalism, all the fields have either conformal weight zero or conformal weight one. So vanishing of the central charge really means that the partition function is one. So essentially you have the same number of bosons and fermions of the same conformal weight. So that's of course not only true at one loop, it's true at all loops. And now the zero mode integration. So we could just do the counting. So we have to get, at one loop, we have to get 16 of these D zero modes. And you can see that some of them can come from the vertex operators, because they involve, the integrated ones involve D, and the others have to come from these Zs and Bs. Okay, the maximum from B tilde can be 4, and from each Z can be 1. So you have to get at least 2 Ds from the vertex operators, and because of this derivative of the delta function, you also need an N zero mode to get something non-vanishing.
So the zero modes of B tilde only come from the zero modes of the other field?
The zero modes of the Ds, say that again? So B tilde has many terms. Now, what was the question about?
So the zero modes of B tilde are the only ones that contribute to your own field. Do they actually come from the zero modes of the other field?
So the zero modes of B tilde are these Ds. So your question was if those are the only zero modes which contribute? So you also get zero modes coming from the vertex operators and from the picture raising operator. So they also contribute zero modes. You know, was that your question?
Well, B tilde is going to have some zero mode, right?
Yeah, so it contributes, for example, four D zero modes.
Right, so but B tilde is a composite field.
Yes.
So do these zero modes come only from zero modes of the canonical field or also from excited modes of the canonical field?
Well, I would call those non-zero modes. Is that what you mean, the excited?
So since B is an unlinear function of the field,
so D, you're saying D is a composite field or D?
D is a composite field.
Yeah. So I'm doing the functional integration over the fundamental world sheet field. So the B is not an field to be integrated over. Maybe that's the confusion. So the integration is over these Ds. And the only part of B that contributes from the zero modes of these Ds.
How do you
know? Oh, okay, so we need to have 16, in order to get something non-vanishing, we need to have 16 D zero modes. So where can they come from? So in this expression, the only objects involving D come from here, here, and here. So if you count how many Ds, only 10 Ds can come from here, and at most, 3 can come from here. So that means the other Ds, if you're going to get something non-vanishing, have to come from this B tilde. And of the terms in B, the only terms involving at least 3 D zero modes is this term here. So none of the other terms can contribute just by a zero mode constant. So that, of course, obviously tells you that if you have fewer than 3 vertex operators, it also must vanish just because you can't get enough Ds. So you need to get at least, in this description, the B tilde would give not 3, but would give 4. So instead of this giving 3, it gives 2 Ds, and it has to give an N because of this delta prime. So this is the only way to soak up the zero mode. Okay, so the fermion integration is trivial just because it's just zero mode. The only thing left is the X zero mode. That just gives the usual Green's function, just like tachyons in bosonic string theory. And then the partition function is simple, so you only get the contribution from the imaginary parts of the period matrix coming from the X's. So this just gives you the usual expression, which is modular invariant. And K is the usual K, so it's this kinetic term, but it's written in a different form. So it's written in a form which naturally involves this integration over the 5 thetas. So the integration over the zero modes is precisely like in the tree amplitudes. So you get this integration over 5 thetas, but now because we have 1 unintegrated and 3 integrated, you can see that you get 1a, 2 w's, and an f. And essentially this is the only way they can contract with this 3 symmetrized spinner indices. So this is the way in the pure spinoformism that this T8T8 appears. And to show that it's T8T8 is not so simple. In fact, this was shown by Engler, Grassi, and Van Hol. So, of course, this also gives you automatically the supersymmetric extension. So it gives you all the 5 forms and the fermions in the same expression.
Can I just ask, back in the top expression, where can I sort of see the period matrix integral d2 tau coming from?
Okay, so I didn't write it explicitly. I should have written. So here's an integration over d squared tau d tau.
Oh, that's an addition.
Sorry, I'm sorry. So there's an integration over all the, and the integration over dx pulls down this factor here of tau to the minus 5. Well, that's, again, it's the same as in bosonic string. The difference is that the partition function in this case is much simpler.
So that's where you would put in carefully that you're going to integrate over one fundamental.
That's right. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's sort of external to what you're discussing.
Yeah. Okay, so the fact that this gives you this T8-T8 structure is, in some sense, it's not so easy to get T8-T8 structure from space-time spinners in a covariant way. So, of course, in Green-Schwarz, you get this T8-T8 structure by integrating over light cone spinners, SO8 light cone spinners, and then you covariantize the expression. In RNS, you get it in a completely different way by these plies. And in this language, somehow it's covariantizing the spinner expression of light cone gauge, but it's doing it in a way which, well, hasn't been done before. Okay, so now the multi-loop amplitude. So all the ingredients are already there, as we have the BGOS and the picture-raising operators. Now, of course, you have more zero modes. Okay, the partition function is one. Now, again, we have to go through this counting. So essentially, it's the counting of the Ds which tells me which amplitudes are forced to vanish. And if you just go through the counting, you find, okay, now you have 3G minus 3 of these, so instead of getting 11G here, you'll get 8G plus 3. And when you go through the counting, you find that in order to be non-vanishing, in order to have 16G zero modes for the Ds, I need to have at least this structure coming from the vertex operator. So you need 1D and 3Ns. If you had fewer than this, so if you had, for example, 1D and 2Ns, or, okay, depending on, well, this is a way to get something which is non-vanishing. If you just have three vertex operators or less, there's no way to get this. So unless, of course, they're massive. So for three massless vertex operators or fewer, the multi-loop amplitude vanishes just by this zero-mode counting. So this is, of course, relevant for these finiteness theorems. This is a non-renormalization theorem, which, okay, it's been verified, of course, and there are different ways to try to claim that you've proven it. I'm not... This is the pure spinner formalism way to prove it. If you want to argue if this is a proof or not, there are questions about if these amplitudes are perfectly, you know. So the vanishing theorems are easy to prove. Things which are hard to prove in this formalism, for example, is unitarity. So normally one wants a real proof of finiteness. One wants not just that these amplitudes vanish, but that the amplitudes are factorizable and satisfy the usual unitarity properties. Until one can show that these amplitudes are equivalent to the light cone gauge computations, it's going to be, well, that's something that still needs to be shown. So, but I think the vanishing theorems are easy to show. So assuming that these amplitudes are consistent, I think finiteness follows in a relatively straightforward way. Okay, so of course, although it's not difficult to get zero, it's more difficult to get something which is non-vanishing. So the first expression, which appears to be, you know, at least in the RNS computation, is tractable at higher loops, is this 4.2 loop. And of course, in RNS, it was only done with external Nevers-Schwarz state. In this formalism, it turns out to be relatively easy to do, just because the question about the zero modes tells you that the four-point amplitude, just because you have to absorb these zero modes from the vertex operators, means that it's, again, as in the one-loop amplitude, the fermionic Wilczek fields only contribute to their zero modes. So again, only certain terms appear coming from the B-ghost. And when you go through the computation, you find that you have a similar structure to what was found in RNS. It's not precisely the same structure, but... Yeah, sorry, this was just too late. So the nice thing that happens with two loops, as was already shown by Dok and Fong, is that you have this simple expression, at least for the Nevers-Schwarz state, which is modular invariant and which has the right properties. In this formalism, what you find is that you need, of course, four integrated vertex operators. So you have so So now, unlike the one loop, now you have four integrated. So you want to get, you have to get this D, N, N, N coming from the four integrated vertex operator. So the D comes from the W in the integrated, and the three N's come from three F's. And now you have to write a structure which contracts these three F's and a W with this D theta 5 with three symmetrized indices. And in fact, again, there's a unique way to write this. So this structure, it comes out, if you like, after doing the integration over the lambdas and the W's. And it involves the same type of structure with this integration over the five thetas. So now they're contracted in a different way. And in fact, it's not at all clear that this is going to reproduce the T8T8 structure. So one has to go ahead and go through that combinatorial computation. And that hasn't been done yet. But the belief is that if you compute this object here and do the sum over the permutations of the states, that you'll reproduce the expression which was computed using the RNS formula. Okay, so this, of course, because it involves, so the other, at one loop, it involved one A, two W's, and an F. This involves three F's and a W, so it's higher order in the momentum. So you see immediately that you don't get any R to the fourth or D squared R to the fourth. The first contribution comes at D to the fourth R to the fourth. And in fact, this structure persists to all loops. So this means that the R to the fourth and D squared R to the fourth don't get corrections above one loop. So that's one of the duality conjectures. And in fact, there are other duality conjectures which suggest that, for example, that D to the fourth R to the fourth does not get contributions above two loops. So it would be nice to be able to verify these higher loop vanishing theorems using this kind of formula. Okay, so I'll stop here.
The issue, of course, of all these things is really to show with high loops that, you know, of all the choices you have made, that somehow these choices don't matter. That's really the hard thing. That's also the hard thing in a lot of times.
Yeah. So, okay, so let me try to give a similar answer to the answer I gave yesterday. So, so in RNS, there's a way to see that as you showed, there are subtleties in the RNS computation which are related to the fact that these vanishing theorems are not obviously vanishing pointwise in moduli space. So if you choose...
the complication, though, is the fact that, you know, even in the RNS formulation, the naive formulation does depend on various joints.
Right.
And there are additional pieces that have to come in, and they're coming from current engagement.
Right. So, but one can see the need for these additional pieces as because if you didn't add these additional pieces, then you would not get these vanishing things. So normally when add these additional pieces, I think of them as sometimes some type of contact term, which is necessary because if you didn't introduce the contact term, then you would be missing some something which should have vanished did not vanish. So it somehow... Yeah, that's one way to say it, but I don't know the correct way to say it. But
I'd rather say that it would be as if you did a gauge theory calculation in psi engaging perturbation theory, and you evaluated the gauge invariant correlation function, and you found that the answer depends on psi.
Right.
That's the fundamental problem.
Right. So all I'm saying is that in this formalism, at least, there's no evidence that there might be some subtlety of that type. Now, of course, there might be some subtlety. I'm not saying that there isn't. But the fact that these vanishing theorems fall without these subtleties suggests that maybe one doesn't. Now, of course, I obviously agree with you that until you check that there are no subtleties, there could be subtleties. So that point, and certainly if one had a more geometrical view of where these picture-changing operators came from, then it would be much clearer about how to show that that the formalism doesn't depend on where I put them on or how I choose the directions, etc. I hope that will come. But so at this point, I certainly would say that this is an incomplete story. But at least it seems to be a more fruitful way of computing. So as you know, I mean, the computation of the 4.2 loop in RNS is much, well, it's not this, maybe 10 times more difficult. I don't know if I would say 100, but this computation, at least the once you set up the computation, if you believe that the computation, that the setup is correct, then the computation is extremely simple. Whereas in RNS, of course, the setup is extremely simple, but the computation is extremely difficult. So this computation can be set up also for the higher loop, and the hope is that that will at least give a first idea of what these higher loop amplitude properties that they have. But of course, okay, using the word proof is probably too strong, but it certainly seems to be a fruitful way, a useful way to compute them.
Some of these vanishing theorems are mere consequence of supersymmetry, and others sort of need a string input. Can you, in your form, make some sort of distinction between the two?
Okay, so it's a little bit difficult. So some people say, for example, the vanishing of the cosmological constant vanishes from supersymmetry. So, but I don't know. So if you can tell me, maybe you can tell me which ones you suspect follow from supersymmetry. So, for example, Martinek tried to use essentially space-time supersymmetry on the world sheet to prove, essentially proved all the vanishing theorems, the 0, 1, 2, and 3 point. But, of course, the problem was that the supersymmetry currents he used were not well-defined on the world sheet. So how would you prove, which vanishing theorems do you think come just from space-time supersymmetry?
Well, usually something where there's one class is where there's a holomorphic cup, where there's a holomorphic, where supersymmetry constrains the coupling in front of some of these R terms to be holomorphic. While what the holomorphic dependence is.
Okay, so your question is about the effective action. Is that one way to say it? So if I can say that the effective space-time supersymmetry, for example, doesn't allow e to the 2g minus 2 phi couplings in front of this term, then you say that that's not allowed. Is that? So even that argument, not enough is known about 10-dimensional superspace, I think, to rule those out. So, for example, Green and Setti and Green showed that with certain assumptions, supersymmetry implied that the R to the fourth did not get corrections above one root. But the assumptions was this SL2Z invariant. So, yeah.
What I was really asking was in your formalism somewhere, you have a representation for supercharge, so you might actually address that question. Maybe you can address that question within your formalism.
Okay, well, one thing I can say is you have the theta zero modes and the D zero mode. The theta zero modes are somehow space-time supersymmetry. Those are the things which exist even for the particle. So in some sense, if you want to say vanishing theorems which follow just from the theta zero modes would be supersymmetry. I think for in this description, only the cosmological constant vanishes using that. If you want to show that either 1, 2, or 3 point function vanishes, I think you need to use the D zero mode. So maybe that's one way to answer your question.
Is it correct to say that at the moment this is tied to just the simplest flat background, and that to do it in a curved background, you have to understand better the gauge invariance?
So no, the sigma model actually, at the classical level, it was shown by myself with Paul Howe that the sigma model, so this world sheet action here generalizes in a straightforward way to a curved background. And you find that BRST invariance implies that the background satisfies the equations of motion, exactly as in bosonic
streams. But you need this constant standard for your picture change.
Okay, the lambda alphas, so they live in the target in the on the tangent space of the sigma model. So it's not like space-time supersymmetry. They're not like the thetas. So the lambda alphas, I don't know the right way to say this, but so this action, for example, the lambdas would generalize to W del bar lambda. So on a curved manifold, they're no longer constant. They're covariantly constant with this. So the del bar would be PDZ bar, but then it would couple to the something like D bar XM. Gamma. So this would be, so del bar lambda would del bar lambda. So they're no longer constant on the world sheet. So this. Okay, so this at the classical level, this is all. If you're asking for amplitude computations, that's like But it, so just at the classical level, so at the tree amplitude level, I think this is a well-defined question. So I mean, computing the amplitude is a well-defined procedure. Of course, if the surface is curved, we don't know how to, you know, you have to be lucky if you can compute the OPE. Now, at the loop level, string loop, I haven't thought about. I don't know, was that your question?
Well, it's anyway, thank you.
Okay.
No more questions.